My name is Danny Boggs. 31 years ago, last week, Ronald Reagan signed my commission as a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and that's what I've been doing since then. This morning's session, the title is The Future of the American Judiciary. Perhaps they had me moderated as representing the past of the American judiciary, but I will be continuing to take 100% caseload as a senior circuit judge, but we will see how that goes. We have talked about documents, the Constitution. We've talked about concepts, the administrative state, the rule of law. And now, with the topic, the future of the American judiciary, we will perhaps also talk about people, because the judiciary is the men and women who fill the places created by and specifically contemplated by the Constitution and our founding. Our overall topic of saving the Constitution struck me as at least slightly odd. You talk about saving Private Ryan in the great movie, that it seems more like a living creature that you're trying to save. And usually, perhaps, we're not saving it as much as trying to preserve it, to restore the Constitution, or perhaps even to make the Constitution great again. Now, in a constitution or in other areas, there are usually three approaches that are taken toward restoring or improving. One is better people, presidential appointments in the government, better leadership in corporations or churches. A second is institutional changes, and we've heard people discuss or advance the Convention of the States, repealing the 17th Amendment, term limits, or jurisdictional changes under Article 3. The third avenue is culture or ideas. Frequently at Philadelphia Society meetings, people will argue, if we don't change the culture or the overall zeitgeist, then all will be lost or other changes would be futile. I will say that personally, I lean in the direction, at least in the judiciary, of that first explanation. I was appointed to the bench shortly after President Reagan appointed Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia to the comparable court that I sat on for the District of Columbia. I was on the bench when Antonin Scalia succeeded in his confirmation to the Supreme Court and when Robert Bork was rejected. And I've since watched every confirmation struggle since then. And in my view, and I think the view of even people with opposing substantive views, our view of the Constitution and its future would be quite different had there been more appointments like Justices Scalia or Thomas and less like Brennan and Breyer. And people with a different substantive view would still have the same view that things would be different had there been more like Brennan and Breyer. So that's the position that I would put out. We'll see what our other folks have to say. The people who are in the judiciary, and I compare them because I've served in the executive and legislative branches in both the state and federal levels, on balance are as good or better people than the kind of counterparts that you would have in the executive and the legislative branches. The question is, what are their ideas? What is their fidelity to proper views of the Constitution? But they're still real people, and they can't always be categorized. They do not uniformly follow what you might think are the uniforms put on them by their appointing presidents. And I want to give you two real-life examples to bring down to the concrete level where I am. The first was called Bible Believers. There's an Arab festival in Dearborn, Michigan. Been going on for many years. It's in a public area. It's not walled off. And some evangelical preachers come through denouncing Muhammad, carrying a pig on a stick, this sort of thing. The crowd begins to heckle, then throw rocks and bottles, bloody them up a bit, but they persist. The police make a half-hearted effort to protect them, but ultimately take them away, saying they're causing the trouble. They sue under the First Amendment civil rights statutes, and a 2-to-1 panel of our court rules against them, rules in favor of the police, saying you're the ones that are causing the trouble, no harm, no foul. The dissenters, perhaps the most liberal judge on our court, one with whom I'd had various past public disagreements, but he and I led the charge to have the court rehear this en banc, and we ultimately won 10-5, saying the First Amendment protected the preachers, their rights had been violated, and 4 of the 5 dissenters were what would have been conventionally called conservatives. They said they're just causing trouble. The liberal judge wrote a very workmanlike opinion that 10 of us signed on to. I also authored a somewhat more polemical concurrence. The dissenters said, well, it's ironic that these preachers are using the First Amendment to disrupt the minority. And I said that the First Amendment does not recognize majority or minority ideas. The First Amendment does not care whether you punch up or punch down. It doesn't care whether you speak truth to power or power to truth, and that irony does not trump the First Amendment. 2 liberals signed on with me on that opinion. 2 conservatives signed on with me on that. If this was a concurrence, we had still won, but it tried to make that point more polemically. 2nd case, we talked about Chevron. Chevron comes up in this case. Mr. Esquivel Quintana was a legal immigrant in the United States, which is fine, but he was convicted of statutory rape in California, which made him potentially deportable. The statute says you can be deported if you commit, quote, sexual abuse of a minor. Well, there's an administrative agency, the Board of Immigration Appeals, that decides cases like this. And they had a past rule and precedent that said if it involved a minor and was a state crime, that would make you deportable. It would be sexual abuse of a minor. The defense was the girl was a little more than 3 years younger than the guy. In many states, this wouldn't be a crime. They have what's called the Romeo and Juliet exception, which was if the girl is less than 4 years, or the guy, it can go either way, less than 4 years younger, then it's not a crime. But it was a crime in California. Precedent of the BIA, administrative agency, I and another judge said Chevron deference, Chevron is the law, firm and fair enforcement of the immigration laws. We had a dissenter, Jeffrey Sutton, who normally most people in this audience, I think, would think well of. And Sutton says, no, we shouldn't give deference to it. It's an administrative agency. Maybe we should push back on Chevron, and then we should have the rule of lenity. Because it's ambiguous, we shouldn't enforce it strictly. Well, it went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court's heard it. Hasn't come down yet. But it's interesting. On the one hand, maybe Sutton is right. We can push back against Chevron. Maybe I was right. We should have firm enforcement of the immigration laws. Again, the people involved are very important. The judiciary as a concept is important, and you can't always, on balance, you generally can. I prefer to have the people that generally agree with me on the court, but they don't always agree. Well, that's an example that we, the individuals, as Teddy Roosevelt said, we are the people in the arena covered with metaphorical, at least, dust and sweat and blood that decide these cases. We have a panel of 3 professors who will address these issues. We know that what professors do is they observe the fight in the arena, they observe the battle from the hilltop, and then they come down after the battle and shoot the wounded. Well, we have 3 expert marksmen to address this topic today. I'll introduce them all, and then they will have at it. The first is Dr. John Eastman. I had it once said that you've heard of a speaker that needs no introduction. John's introduction virtually needs no speaker. He has a PhD from Claremont Graduate School. He followed that going to University of Chicago Law School, graduating at the top of his class, went on to clerk for Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, has public appearances too numerous to mention, and for 17 years has been a professor of law at Chapman University. The second speaker will be Michael Federici, who this fall is taking up his new position as department chair and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State. For the previous 25 years almost, he has been on the faculty at Mercyhurst, where he has also been department chair, faculty senate president, and on the university board of trustees. His topics also take another slant on this: the challenge of populism, the political philosophy of Alexander Hamilton, and the culture of immodesty in American life, the modest republic. Our third speaker, Christopher Wolfe, is professor of politics at the University of Dallas, right here, and president of the American Public Philosophy Institute. His titles are also right in our wheelhouse: The Rise of Modern Judicial Review, How to Read the Constitution, and this one I really like, Judicial Activism, A Bulwark of Freedom or a Precarious Security. I now give you Dr. John Eastman.